Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
President Bush today tapped Air Force General Michael Hayden to become the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The president made the announcement in the Oval Office this morning and said Hayden would continue the CIA's goal of increasing the number of spies in the field, a plan developed by outgoing CIA Chief Porter Goss.
This plan involves increasing the number of operatives and sources in the field and building up the agency's analytical capabilities, so the hardworking men and women of the CIA have the resources they need to penetrate closed societies and secretive organizations.
Well, joining us from Washington with more on the nomination is Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, good to be here.
And as you know, the image of the president standing with the nominee today drove home the point many critics are making. Hayden was in his uniform. Critics have qualms about a military officer heading a civilian intelligence agency, and he's confirmed military officers will run all major spy agencies. Was there any mention this morning that the president might step down from the military in order to accept the CIA position?
Well, there is some discussion that that might happen, but the critics of Mike Hayden, chiefly Congressman Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, he says that doesn't make any difference. He thinks there'll be a perception problem with having so many military men in charge of intelligence, that that it would send the message out both in Washington and into the field that intelligence has become a military franchise, and that there isn't that kind of separation.
Right. And the White House has said that they would balance that conflict perhaps by moving the number two man at the agency out. He's a vice admiral, and that they'd put a civilian in that position.
Right. But there's been a lot of focus on whether someone wears a uniform or not, and what the proponents of Mike Hayden are trying to point out is that you need talented people in these positions at a time when terrorism remains a grave threat. And just because Mike Hayden wears a uniform, it doesn't mean he's unqualified. In fact, he has quite a bit of experience with intelligence, having run the National Security Agency.
Well, in fact, people wonder, though, if his experience with intelligence is the right experience, given that he's seen as an expert in satellites and technology, but not in human intelligence. Is that being talked about?
Sure, that's one of the criticisms of Mike Hayden, but the point is that his job is to reform intelligence, his job, if he's confirmed, and to put in place the kind of intelligence system that we need to meet the terrorist threat. And it seems to me that what's needed more than anything is just to have a good manager. I think Porter Goss, among his problems is that he just didn't seem to be a good manager of a large bureaucracy like the Central Intelligence Agency. And, that, I think, more than anything is what's needed at this time.
Well, and as you say, it's pointed out that he was a chief defender of the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program at the National Security Agency. This is General Hayden, currently principal deputy director of National Intelligence. Might some see this confirmation process as a chance to get more information about the warrantless wiretapping program?
Absolutely. This is something that Senator Specter has been raising over the weekend, that this is a chance to delve into that more. Now, the White House would welcome that battle. This is, they think, a winning issue for them at a time when the president is sinking ever further in job approval ratings down into the low 30s. This terrorism is one of his best issues, and on balance, he believes that the public supports him on warrantless surveillance, and so they want this argument.
Well, Republicans have been pretty critical. Republican Representative Peter Hoekstra of Michigan called Hayden the wrong man at the wrong place at the wrong time. Susan Collins, a senator from Maine, is one saying that he might want to step down, retire from the Air Force to send a signal of independence from the Pentagon. But what are Democrats saying?
Well, Democrats are being kind of quiet. You've had Senator Biden speaking out, but by and large, I think they like to watch the Republicans beating up on themselves, and so they're going to sit back and let that play out. But I think in the end, I think the odds are strong that Hayden will be confirmed, because the Republicans know that in the end, if they beat up President Bush too hard over this and cause Hayden to go down, that that's just bad for the party in general and during an election campaign.
Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us about today's nomination of Air Force General Mike Hayden to become the new director of the CIA. Linda, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Well, on a day when the CIA is so much in the news, it's perhaps appropriate that we talk about a man who for so long was a thorn in the side of the agency, Daniel Ortega, the former president of Nicaragua, the man who led the Sandinista War against the CIA-funded Contras in the 80s, is plotting a political comeback. Ortega is hoping to take advantage of a surge by leftist political leaders in Latin America, and he is a candidate for president in November's election. And as Stephen Kinzer writes in the American Prospect, U.S. officials are pretty much back where they were 20 years ago, hoping to once again defeat Daniel Ortega. Stephen Kinzer is former New York Times bureau chief in Nicaragua. He's also author of the new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. And we want to spend a few minutes with him today. He's speaking to us from Chicago. Welcome, Stephen.
Great to be with you.
And Stephen, can we go to recent history first? Because I'm sure there are people saying Ortega, Noriega, Which guy is this? The leftist Sandinista Front deposed the 40-year Somoza dictatorship in 1979. Daniel Ortega led that government, but in the 80s, Ronald Reagan decided the Sandinistas were a threat to the U.S., the CIA was dispatched, and then what?
The CIA organized a group of disgruntled former officers of the old regime. It put them together in camps in Florida, sent them down to Honduras, and began waging war on the Sandinistas. So Daniel Ortega was the leader of this left-wing Sandinista government during the 1980s, and his enemy on the battlefield was a force of Nicaraguans that had been organized, armed, and paid by the CIA.
And, of course, before we move from that past history, the other phrase that's floating up is Iran-Contra. U.S. Operatives secretly sold guns to Iran, which was at the time fighting Iraq, and gave the money to the Contras fighting Daniel Ortega.
The U.S. Congress, along with many Americans, was very upset at the idea that the CIA was sponsoring this war in Central America. At a certain point in the mid-80s, Congress actually cut off money for the Contras. But President Reagan was eager, as he told one of his advisors, to keep them together body and soul. So his advisors went out and devised this bizarre scheme where they sold weapons to Iran clandestinely and then siphoned the money into another account that was used to buy weapons for the Contras. So in an odd way, that struggle in Nicaragua was tied to the continuing conflict far on the other side of the world in Iran.
Ultimately, Ortega, the Sandinistas, were deposed in an election, as you write, after the rebels, the Contras, agreed to stop fighting. But then what happened?
Nicaragua was in a very odd position. Ever since its most important government, its most formidable government, was overthrown almost 100 years ago, it's been in a constant cycle of repression and rebellion. The United States focuses tremendous attention on it and then turns the other way completely. And that's exactly what happened after 1990. The U.S. had essentially turned Nicaragua into what it thought was the most important place in the world, where the decisive battle for civilization was going to be fought. And then suddenly, in the space of less than a year, it decided Nicaragua didn't matter to anyone anymore. As a result, ever since then, Nicaragua, from the perspective of Americans, might just as well have sunk right under the ocean.
In fact, you write that Nicaragua today competes with Haiti to lead Latin America in most things that are bad. How bad is it?
Nicaragua is actually a very, very poor country, even by Central American standards. It has never managed to develop itself into a stable social democracy the way neighboring Costa Rica has, for example. That's one of the saddest aspects of this American cycle of focusing intense attention on Nicaragua for a while and then completely abandoning it.
One businessman told you Nicaragua is near a critical point in its history as we, you know, we're about to look at this upcoming election. What did he mean by that?
Something very interesting is happening in Nicaragua. As in many Latin American countries, that country's political history has been dominated by these outsized figures they call caudillos in Latin America, dictators who rule over long periods of time. Now, many countries in Latin America have grown beyond that phase in their history. Nicaragua may be at the moment now when it can break away from that. There are two main political parties, the Sandinistas and the Liberals. Each one is dominated by a caudillo, one of these giant sort of dictator figures. But within each party, there is now a rebellion going on. So if in either one of those parties, or ideally both of them, the rebel factions could be successful, this period of caudillo rule might finally give way to some kind of solid institutional democracy.
And it's so interesting that Daniel Ortega, who saw himself as someone who overthrew, you know, Somoza, overthrew a caudillo, he's now seen as one?
You're absolutely right. He thought of himself as a guy who would overthrow the old-style leaders, and now he's becoming one exactly in their model. He also felt that one of the things that the traditional political parties did that was the most outrageous was that they would make deals with each other and decide that together they would take power and then apportion the Supreme Court justices and the members of Congress according to their own will. Now, under his rule, that is exactly what the Sandinistas and liberals are doing. So this man who started out his career seeming to rebel against all that traditional Nicaraguan politics represented has turned out to be a perfect exemplar of that same political system he seemed to be rebelling against.
In fact, you write in a recent poll, 69% of Nicaraguans said they wouldn't vote for him under any circumstance. Who's his opposition in the Sandinista Party?
The guy who was rebelling against Ortega in the Sandinista Front is a very unusual, not to say unique, figure in Nicaragua. He's the balding 66-year-old son of a Jewish candy manufacturer from Poland who somehow turned up in Nicaragua in the early part of this century. This guy was a Sandinista himself since his teenage years. He was a gun runner based in California, was finally arrested by U.S. police and spent several months in a federal prison for his gun smuggling operations on behalf of the Sandinistas during the 1970s. He then became part of the Sandinista government, worked very closely with Daniel Ortega, and most recently was mayor of Managua. In that last job, he developed quite a reputation for his kind of endearing style and kind of can-do mentality that put the ability to get projects done ahead of political loyalty, which is something unusual in Nicaragua. So he's got quite a personal following. Herti Lewitis is his name. And factions behind him include many that have been loyal Sandinistas over many years, but want the party to democratize rather than to continue being essentially the personal property of Daniel Ortega.
And as you point out, there's also a split in the opposing Liberal Party. We're going to find out more about that and how the U.S. is once again getting involved in Nicaraguan politics. That's after a break. We're speaking with Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times bureau chief in Nicaragua. He's author of the new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. We'll touch on that as well. And don't forget, later, we're going to speak to some grad students who've come up with a plan for local governments in the event of an avian flu pandemic. Do you think your boss will let you work from home? And who gets the state's ventilators in the event of an outbreak? Fascinating stuff. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. He writes about the upcoming presidential race in Nicaragua in the latest edition of the American Prospect magazine. And as he says, a familiar face might be on the ballot. Daniel Ortega, the former president who led the country in its war against the CIA-sponsored Contras, is running again. But his Sandinista party is split, as is the rival Liberal Party. We want to hear more about that and about how U.S. officials are getting involved in the race. But Stephen Kinzer, first, you were in Nicaragua recently. From your vantage point, how does what's happening there reflect what's going on in the rest of Latin America?
The Nicaragua situation has always been different from the rest of Central America, but in terms of placing it into the larger context of Latin America and Latin America's drift to the left, Some people have seen it as a reflection of this Hugo Chavez phenomenon. I actually would see it a little differently. Venezuela has never really had a lot of influence over Central America or Nicaragua, but Mexico has. And now in Mexico, there is the prospect of a leftist president being elected in the next couple of months. If that happens, then I think it would really mean wind in Daniel Ortega's sails. And this figure, whom the United States has considered one of its great boogeymen in Central America now for a generation, might find himself back on the political scene.
And how are U.S. officials reacting to that? After all, they sort of turned the other way. Is there a sign that the U.S. might get back involved with Nicaraguan politics?
It's already happening. After more than a decade of ignoring Nicaragua completely, the prospect now of Ortega returning to power has mobilized the United States in a way that Nicaragua's miserable poverty never was able to. So this prospect has led the U.S. to begin to focus on the rebel figure within the Liberal Party. This fellow, Mr. Montealegre, is a Harvard-educated economist, and he has become the favored candidate of the United States. The U.S. Would obviously prefer that Ortega not wind up as the Sandinista candidate, but they don't trust any Sandinistas, really. This administration in Washington now feels that we want an anti-Sandinista candidate, and the candidate that the U.S. is clearly supporting now is Montealegre. Just the fact, however, that the U.S. has a candidate and is letting everyone in Nicaragua know who is the U.S.-backed candidate is rubbing some people there the wrong way, and that's a result of more than 100 years of very unfortunate American intervention in Nicaragua.
You remind us that the first leader to be deposed in Nicaragua by the U.S. was Jose Zelaya, and that was in 1909. It's a cautionary tale about U.S. involvement in other countries. We're reminded the title of your book is Overthrow: America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Nicaragua resonates especially now.
The overthrow of Zelaya in 1909 still has effects today, and that's why it's such a perfect example of the unintended long-term results of American intervention. Zelaya actually was a modernizing capitalist, but he got into trouble because he tried to regulate American corporations that were active in Nicaragua. They complained about him to Washington. Ultimately, he was overthrown. The repressive regime that replaced him produced a rebellion. The U.S. had to send Marines there to put down that rebellion. The Marines finally left. Then there was another uprising. The Marines had to be sent back. Finally, we imposed the Somoza family dictatorship. The Sandinistas rebelled against them. There's probably no country in the world where it is possible to trace the history of rebellion against U.S.-imposed regimes over a longer period and more directly than it is in Nicaragua.
It also points to, as we watch the conflict in Iraq unravel on many levels, it also points to the importance of the U.S. staying involved with a country once it decides to execute regime change.
The crucial moment in all these regime change operations, and the same thing happened in Nicaragua, comes right after we overthrow the leader. Then we have to decide who to put in as the new leader. Well, we want a guy that fulfills two qualifications. First, it should be someone popular who the people support. And secondly, it should be somebody who'll do what we want. But we quickly find out you can't have both. If you have somebody who's going to be popular, it's going to be because he puts the interest of his own country first. But we don't want that. We want someone who'll put our interests first. That's why we overthrew the government. So we impose someone who's not popular, but will do what we want. He requires increasing amounts of repression to stay in power because he's not popular. We then have to help him in his repressive campaigns, which turns us into the enemy of the people in that country. That ultimately leads to explosions that produce regimes far more anti-American than the ones we originally intervened to overthrow.
Well, that's one scenario, but another one would seem to be closer to the Nicaraguan, which is there is regime change, and then, as you said, the U.S. walks away.
This has happened time and time again in Nicaragua, and it's shown that the U.S. is not really interested in the long-term development of that country. That would have really been an investment in American national security. Nicaragua, had we not intervened there or remained engaged there after we did intervene, might have become a stable and prosperous democracy that exported stability to the rest of Central America. In fact, in the case that happened, it has become just the opposite.
Well, and now, Stephen Kinzer, there's the possibility of, as you said, because the U.S. has expressed distaste for Daniel Ortega as the president once again in Nicaragua, there might be a backlash against the U.S.-picked candidate. And as you said, it could happen. Even though he's unpopular with Nicaraguans, Daniel Ortega could return as president. Does that mean that it sets up the possibility of Daniel Ortega perhaps coming to the U.S. to try to figure out a future for his country, given the huge poverty there?
I don't think the Americans quite understand what it looks like to Nicaraguans when we go down and try to intervene in their political affairs or show our preferences for their future political course. Nicaraguans don't welcome this just because of their own history. I think it could possibly backfire against the United States, and then the U.S. would face this very extraordinary possibility of having to face Daniel Ortega, the same person we faced on the battlefield in the 1980s as an unreconstructed leader of anti-American political forces throughout Central America.
Stephen Kinzer's article about November's presidential race in Nicaragua appears in the May issue of The American Prospect. He's also author of the new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Well, stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the
Asia confirmed that a man has become the 25th person there to die of bird flu. The lethal strain of the virus has killed 113 people worldwide, mostly in Asia. No one knows if or when a virus might become a pandemic, but the White House response plan released last week says that if there is an outbreak, the illness will probably spread in two or three global waves, each lasting about 3 months. At least one-third of the U.S. population would become sick, and the White House is advising citizens not to wait for help from Washington. Some health experts say the White House plan leaves several critical questions unanswered, such as who will be given limited vaccines and medical equipment. Well, some students of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government just participated in an exercise to try to answer some of those questions. And joining us here in the studio are Joanne Kuba, who was born in Iraq and is getting her master's in public policy at the Kennedy School. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you very much.
We're also joined by your colleague and fellow student, Jeff Roth, an Army National Guard reservist. And like Joanne, you're getting your master's in public policy as well?
That's correct.
And welcome to you as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
Well, you both participated in this exercise, which is something that all first-year grad students at the Kennedy School participate in. Only this year, the focus was the flu pandemic. You were asked to play advisors to Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. The scenario is that he wants advice before a flu outbreak hits. On how to make decisions in two critical areas. Jeff, can you first describe those areas?
Sure, absolutely. Well, there are two areas. One was social distancing, and the other was ventilator allocation, how we use that scarce resource. I focused on the ventilator allocation, whereas Joanne focused on the social distancing.
Good. Then you can tell us what that means, Joanne. What is that?
Social distancing is a preventative measure that people can take from the beginning when they hear that there is a pandemic outbreak, things that self-shield themselves.
Right. In our business, people are talking about having people have microphones in their home. So this is not quarantine. This is distancing. Distancing yourself from people who might be sick.
Absolutely. This is empowering the individual to be able to come up with strategies to stay away from large groups of people, things like rotating work schedules. So it's not quarantine.
So this isn't like martial law, for instance. This is just advice in your scenario.
Absolutely. When there is one isolated case, for example, perhaps you would engage in shutting down a school just until a situation is assessed whether it's something that's more severe or not.
By the way, in your scenario, Joanne, do you ever see it getting to the point where Governor Romney, in this case here in Massachusetts, might say, stay home.
order people to stay home, National Guard come out or something like that?
In a case where we have several human-to-human cases being detected, in our scenario, we did have levels of social distancing. And so to the point where you would cancel events, and then even more extreme than that, yes, you would get into the point where you would have to take more severe measures. Because the key is, if you do prevention well, you can contain the outbreak a lot better than if you don't, because of something that might occur later.
Joanne Kuba, who participated in an exercise at the Kennedy School of Government here at Harvard in Massachusetts, you know, what would they tell Governor Romney to do in the event of an avian flu pandemic? Jeff, your focus was on, as you said, rationing ventilators. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by ventilators, by the way?
Well, ventilators, it's medical equipment that helps people breathe, and it's most needed for people that would suffer from the most severe symptoms of the flu.
Are these portable, or you'd have to go to the hospital to get them?
They're portable, but not portable in the sense that an individual could move it around. So, yes, you have to be in the hospital to use a ventilator.
Right. And what's perceived to be the problem here?
Well, the problem is the state forecast that in the most likely scenario, we're going to need 3,352 ventilators. Mm-hmm. Currently available in the state, we have 918. So there's a shortage there. And the way we examined this problem was finding a way to get the most resources to the most people. And the state has divided the state into five different regions. And we thought it was best to distribute the ventilators across those regions equitably.
That's the tricky part, equitably. I mean, it's one thing to do this on paper, but what would you do if, let's say, it's a Hurricane Katrina atmosphere and you came across hospitals barring the door and saying, you can't take our ventilator?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a state of emergency, a lot of that is dependent on, you know, there's certain legal issues that arise, and the governor does have some powers if that was the issue. However, I think it goes back to sort of this planning and this drilling, and I think that typically in emergency-type situations, people come together in a way that they may not otherwise. And I think if we're planning initially and rehearsing and drilling, we kind of understand that process, and we know that the best response is to distribute the ventilators so that the most people can use them. If you've got one hospital that has all the ventilators, everyone's going to be flocking to that hospital. So if you distribute them, you're just sending more resources out to
them. And what is the situation now? Are there hospitals that have many more than others?
By region, yes. There's one region in particular that has quite a bit fewer available ventilators than the others.
Which is that?
It's the surrounding communities of Boston that have the fewest number of ventilators per
really?
Person. Correct.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, but the state did just announce in a press release that they've just bought another 1,200 ventilators. And in their most likely case scenario, that's about half of the ventilators that will be required to come to that 3,352.
You know, Joanne and Jeff, both of you, what I'm hearing is, it sounds great, but I'm also remembering that FEMA had a plan for Katrina, which we now saw was disastrous. There are so many other questions about who's going to get the vaccines and where they should be stockpiled, who's going to pay for things, and the recent report that the communities are pretty much going to be on their own, that the federal government feels that this should be a, you know, grassroots up effort as opposed to federal government down. How do you feel about that when it comes to each of your topics? Start with you, Joanne. I mean, maybe distancing is something only a local government can do.
I think, in a way, some people might get fearful of the fact that it feels like they're being left alone, but I really do think that decentralizing it to the local individuals is actually a very important step. One of the big areas that we also looked at in terms of closures of different sites was how easily you can turn a site into something that has an alternative use. For example, schools. We can easily turn schools into places that could be the first step of triage, because it's very important to isolate where the spread is coming from. For example, in SARS, they didn't quickly look at in Toronto where the spread was occurring. People were always going to the hospitals, and that's actually where the spread was occurring the most.
And Jeff, some of the talk lately has been about the federal government not just emulating large companies like Walmart and Target, which seemed better prepared for Katrina than the federal government did, parking their trucks in certain areas, better able to distribute things, but actually using Walmart, for instance, to distribute vaccines, making Walmart almost a de facto, you know, arm of the government. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I think it's a great idea, because I think a response, you know, in a situation like a Katrina or a possible flu pandemic, you need the whole community involved, and you need tie-in from the private sector, from the public sector, as well as the local community itself.
Are you afraid of a flu pandemic? Are you?
Am I afraid? No, not at all. I think as long, and this exercise very much shows that we're planning for it and we're thinking through this. And I think as long as we're planning and rehearsing, I feel very confident in what we're able to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with Jeff. I think after doing this exercise, initially when we first started, I thought, oh my gosh. But when you start planning and understanding what it is that you can do as a person, it really does empower you.
Yeah. Is it possible that all the planning in the world won't be able to overcome public panic?
Sure. I think that's having strong leadership and really emphasizing that individuals can do something about it. Panic gets you nowhere, whereas being efficient in what you're trying to do is the key.
Jaron Kuba, Jeff Roth, both getting their master's in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. They both took part in an exercise examining how governments can respond to a possible avian flu pandemic, and we thank you both. You're listening to Here and Now. It's not the first time it's happened, but when someone who's an activist against violence becomes a victim of that violence, it seems especially unfair. This past weekend, Izora Mendez lost her second son in the seventh killing in 7 days here in Boston. Police say Alex Mendez, known as Matthew, was found shot dead not far from where his brother Bobby was stabbed to death in 1995. This Sunday, Izora was expected to march with Boston's mayor, as she has for years, in the annual Mother's Day March for Peace. Yesterday, the mayor was one of a stream of mourners at her home. Azora's friend Clementina Sherry joins us now. She founded the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute after her son was killed. And I can't imagine your reaction when you heard Azora's second son was killed.
Words cannot describe what one goes through, especially someone that you know, and then you hear that their son was murdered on the street.
Do you think that because her son Alex had actually joined his mom in her community activism, do you think that's why he was targeted?
No, I don't. I think, you know, if that's why he was targeted, then we need to ask ourselves a question, why were the other six targeted? There should never be any reason why one mother's child will kill another mother's child.
Well, how tough is it, though, for community activists? To remind people, we've reported on the story here in Boston where there was a T-shirt that was sold that said, "Stop snitching." And, you know, it was a part of an intimidation campaign against people who might come forward and either witness to violence or fight against violence. How hard is it to be an activist?
Being an activist is hard, but again, not being an activist can become even harder. Every day when we hear it, every murder is difficult and it makes you want to quit. Hearing that Matthew was killed somehow was different, because now it reinforces that we need to continue to work even harder to take to the streets and to say we want no more killing in our children's name.
Well, what do you think is the problem? You mentioned seven murders in 7 days, and before that many more. The mayor has complained of gun trafficking from neighboring states. I know you think it's a very complex problem, a lot of social issues involved here as well, but do you think it's also a matter of police? Is there something concrete that can be a short-term solution?
Well, I think something concrete that can be a short-term solution is for us to have a clear foundation and for us to realize that there is a greater power that is guiding us. I think we have forgotten that there is a God, and God is guiding all of us, and we have to go back to that foundation.
Well, you know, it's not, somebody might say, well, she's talking about religion or faith, but people in your neighborhood have said that there's something wrong, that there's some disconnect, that there seems to be no conscience behind these shootings.
You know, it's not that one quick fix. We have the trafficking of guns, and we can get rid of the guns, but we don't go after the source of the guns. And then people are prosecuting, but you have district attorneys and you have defense attorneys that are cutting deals, and these young men are being let back out on the street. So we're not going after the solution. We have to look at the root cause of what is causing this, and we have to begin to change the system, you know, from a criminal justice system to a restorative justice system where people are held accountable. So it's not religion. It's belief, and we have to have a belief.
In March, Governor Romney signed anti-intimidation legislation that would provide for statewide witness protection programs, housing for witnesses. Do you think that is part of the solution?
That is a very, very, very small part of the solution, because, again, witness protection, who are we protecting? who are we protecting and how long are we protecting? And are we protecting the entire family? Or are we protecting somebody who was a part of the destruction? Hmm. And now, because they can give information, we're going to cut a deal and we're going to protect them, mm-hmm. and then we're going to put them back out on the street.
Clementina Sherry, she founded the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute in 1994 after her own son was shot dead. She's commenting after a week of violence in Boston, including the death over the weekend of the second son to die by violence of another peace activist, Esora Mendez. I'm imagining that your march this Sunday, the upcoming Mother's Day March Against Violence here in Boston, is going to be a pretty profound one.
It is going to be profound, but again, it's even more of a reason for us to come out and to stand together to protect each other's children.
Do you know if Esora Mendez will be marching or will she be buried?
You know what? She probably will not be marching, but we do know that the families, the cousins, the aunts, the uncles, that is their commitment. And that's what we can do. And if she's not marching, she will still be there with us, and we will be carrying her in our hearts.
Clementina Sherry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. As world-weary as the papier-mâché bell at the wedding where they meet, almost have casual sex in the coat closet, but instead of a one-night stand, John and Jane have an idea. Let's tell each other everything. Full disclosure. They make a pledge to become long-distance pen pals, to write long letters that detail all of their previous relationships. A recipe for romantic disaster? Perhaps, but also for page-turning reading. Which brings me to you is a novel in confessions. The fictional characters John and Jane are brought to life by author Steve Almond. Welcome, Steve.
Hey.
And we should say, of course, Steve Almond, also here and now, literary contributor on occasion, back with your own book. And Juliana Baggett.
Hi.
Welcome back to you as well. We talked to you about your 2003 novel, The Madam, inspired by your grandmother who grew up in a brothel run by her mother. And now we have your new book. Whose idea was it to have two authors each create one character by writing letters back and forth?
That would be my fault. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know where it came from. I guess the term a novel in confessions came first. And then I thought, well, to have a good confession, you need it takes two people. And so I started to think about who would be the perfect match for writing what I call flailing love.
And who would it be?
And it would be Steve Almond.
It would be. And so let's just, so that people understand, you both actually, you know, penned the parts of your character. You, Juliana, did Jane, and you did John, Steve?
Right. The characters are engaged in this extended power flirt. You know, they're trying to show off on paper for one another and get to know one another. And that's what we were doing as writers throughout the whole process. We just went back and forth. Very quick first draft.
We should say this is adult material. These are two people who have...
You should say that, right?
Yes. They've been around. They've had relationships, and they tell about them pretty graphically. We've edited some passages, and this gives you an idea. Can you set up the passage that we're about to hear, the letter we're about to hear?
They meet at the wedding, and then he sends the first confession, and she didn't expect a confession at all, and so she's completely flabbergasted and kind of, you know, frozen up. As it turns out, I'm no fan of honesty. I prefer well-told lies. So I'm in a bind. I mean, it's one thing to suggest a rendezvous in a coat closet with someone and quite another to talk about the truth of your past. And no offense, but what little I know of you indicates that you might start off hot and heavy, but when it comes right down to it, you're likely to call in the troops and retreat. Is this true? At the last minute, are you going to pack up your toys and just go home, Johnny? Sensefully yours, Jane.
He responds, Dear Calamity Jane, oh no you don't. A deal's a deal, lady friend. The contract called for several confessions, heavy on the lurid disclosure with the option of one gratuitous sex scene. We both signed. Now help me out here because I'm still trying to get this straight. I restrain myself from making sweet Wang Dang in the coat check at the wedding and confess that I broke up with my high school sweetie and suddenly I'm a flight risk? Huh? No. Or wait, let me put it this way. I've felt some of that secret skin. I know a little about your mouth. Isn't there something you want to tell me? Something filthy and lovely and true?
Steve, what was it that so astonished Juliana's character, Jane, that your character wrote?
Well, I think the thing that most unsettles her, of course, there's plenty of flailing love with lots of graphic detail, trademark Steve Almond, 2006. But in fact, I think the thing that's the most unsettling and that I didn't realize when we started writing, you know, we were trying to get to know these characters as well, is that he has a kind of a big tragedy hanging over him. His older sister has died, who he clearly worshipped. Mm. And
she was spun from gold.
Yeah, spun from gold. And, you know, just because I have an older brother who I worshipped, and, you know, so I knew that was going to, or you never know, but I could see that I was writing in some sense about an older sibling who you revere. And, of course, it's supposed to be a confession of romantic misdeeds, so Juliana's character is like, what is this guy dumping on me? You know, yeah. It was heavy.
In fact, I just want to jump in and say one of the things I loved about these exchanges, a lot of sex in a lot of different places with a lot of different people, but always came back to some family relationship with parents, with siblings. It's one thing I hated about Sex and the City. They didn't seem to have any relatives mm-hmm. that had any impact on them. But Juliana, jump in with that. Family and siblings, and that was an important part of these young people's sex lives.
Right, and they keep coming back to those roots. And I think that really the point of the novel where Steve and I broke down as writers and started screaming at each other. And as the characters start screaming at each other is when that really gets very pointed. And he says, you remind me of my mother. And this is, you know, the giant mother alarm. Like, she can't believe that he's pushed the hot button, basically, of the relationship. So that's when things got really complicated for us as writers, when these two characters started to go after each other and when we followed suit.
Talk to me a little more about that, because these are characters that are having these, you know, intense exchanges, and they only met one night. This is just through the letters.
But in a certain way, think about how much happy talk travels between people. This is, in an odd way, a throwback to a time where words were really more precious. So they can confess because they don't have the physical proximity, and it's half in the realm of fantasy. They can tell one another things that they would never tell if they were casually dating. And what Juliana is mentioning is that there's a kind of romancing that was going on between us as writers with our aesthetics and our imaginations, and we were trying to get the other writer to fall in love with our character, using the characters as proxies. And it was like the beginning of a relationship, right? When we were first writing, everybody's happy, nobody burps, it's, you know, wonderful. And then as time goes on, you start to find out more and more about the person. And in that case, Juliana and I were finding out about one another as writers and starting to drive one another crazy, and, you know.
And we should say, you are both happily married individually as writers.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how did that enter into it? Because you say it's very, there was a seduction going on here and very sexual content. I mean, was there ever like you'd get something from Steve, Juliana, and blush? You know,
oh, gosh,
your character
yeah.
Blush?
I still read this novel and blush all the way through. My parts, his parts, all the way through, head to toe blush.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're blushing now.
Yes, I am. But, you know, as far as relationships go, my husband never was upset by it. He didn't love that Algonquin called it our love child, the book Our Love Child. He felt that was going a little too far. But, you know, never felt uncomfortable or anything. I mean, I think he was enjoying the process. He enjoyed getting the installments just as we enjoyed getting the installments.
And he titled the book.
Oh.
You know, it's his title, which we both immediately loved. And for two hardcore narcissists like us to give up, you know, naming rights to a book, you really have to kind of hit it out of the park.
Well, and Steve, how much did you each in this sort of seduction, because again, you're reacting to each installment that you get from the other author and then going back in, right? You didn't map this out prior.
No, not at all.
So how much did you, in this desperation to get your letter back, pull on your own life?
I'm long past trying to tell people that my work is an autobiographical. I think every writer tries to do this little dance because they want to say, here's my writing. Don't ask me. That's a People magazine question. Don't ask me what it's based on. It, you know. But all the writing that matters, it's your deepest preoccupations, the stuff you're afraid of. You might play with them a little bit, but it really comes from deep inside of me, and I'm pretty frank about that.
We're not going to tell the ending.
No.
We'll leave that to readers. But do you miss them, this pen pal relationship that you two had, putting the book together?
Yeah, now is the time for real awkward silence. And, no, I think of it this way, because we went through some real battles, and we had to fight in order for us to get deeper into the characters. One character had to say to another, you're not being really truthful with me yet. We had to get angry. That's what makes relationships real. And I now think of it, having gone through that, as like we are an incredibly amicably divorced couple who loves the kid.
Right. That's a perfect analogy. Yeah. And I don't know that we'll ever be remarried, you know, like those weird couples who remarry for, you know,
Elizabeth Taylor,
a sequel.
And, right.
But people may just have to enjoy this one.
Juliana Baggett, Steve Almond. The book is Which Brings Me to You, A Novel in Confessions. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We tell each other everything about the lovers in our past and why they didn't last.
Isn't It Just Perfect? The song, I mean. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.